Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Hi, thank you all for joining us for our lecture series event this evening. We're delighted to have Rod Ferguson with us from the Bay Area. He's a co-founder and managing director of Panorama Capital and has shared a day with us of a whole series of meetings, and we're delighted that many students and young entrepreneurs have had a chance to visit with him. We will be going with our normal process, 45 to 50 minutes, and then we'll have Q&A. Please wait for the mic on either side, and then we'll dive into some direct questions with Rod Ferguson. Thanks very much. Please join us in welcoming Rod Ferguson.
Thanks. Can you guys hear me okay out there? Thanks for taking the time on your Thursday evening to show up. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the current environment and entrepreneurial spirit. I'm going to do this in three parts. I'm going to talk to you about being an entrepreneur and what that means and some of the aspects of that. I'm going to give you a lot of data on venture capital, which is the primary funding source in America for entrepreneurs. And then I'm going to tell you about opportunities that you might have when you get out of this great institution to gain gainful employment. So I thought about doing it this way for you, 10 commandments of the entrepreneur. These are from years of experience in entrepreneurial venture-backed companies and as a venture capitalist backing companies. So let's just go through these. An entrepreneur never quits, no matter what. They are indefatigable, tireless, indestructible, positive attitude, simply never gives up. That is probably the single greatest attribute of an entrepreneur. Every day they do the impossible with no resources and go beyond above the call of duty. There was a TV show in the 80s, if any of you remember MacGyver. It's a MacGyver project every day. Fear of failure. I was telling a story today about Jack Welch, who early in his career at General Electric blew up a plastics plant and was promptly promoted. And that was an environment that accepted failure by those who took calculated risks and rewarded it, and it's a great notion. Entrepreneurial companies and entrepreneurs do not have a fear of failure. If you're afraid to fail, don't try to be an entrepreneur because it comes with the territory. Seeking the wisdom of elders. All of you in this room have great professors here. In my life, I've sought out a great many mentors. I got a lot of good advice. Good entrepreneurs constantly look for individuals who can help them in their careers or in the science or whatever it is they're up to and give them advice about their business all the way through. Boards of directors serve that role for corporations, but each of you as an individual is responsible for your own career, and so you should seek at all times starting now to find mentors and elders who have gone before you can share their insights. The entrepreneur sees over the horizon. The great entrepreneurs, and I was privileged, a guy named Bob Swanson, who was the founder of a little venture-backed company called Genentech, was a mentor to me. And people like Bob could literally see over the horizon. The great entrepreneurs knew what was coming before anybody else knew what was coming. And to kind of quote the great hockey player Wayne Gretzky, it was really easy. You just had to skate to where the puck was going to be. The great entrepreneurs knew where the markets in the world were going, and they got there first. Five more, since this is the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt know your customer and distribution channel. In any business, it doesn't matter what it is, you have a customer, a client that you have to serve. You need to never, ever, ever lose focus of what it is the customer wants from you as a business person. And the distribution channel is simply the way in which you get your product out into the marketplace. You need to understand how that works. Often, people get the customer piece right and the distribution channel wrong. You need to know both, that is, who your customer is and how to get your product through to them in the marketplace. We'll talk a little bit more some of this later on. Frugal with your funding as a venture capitalist. This is near and dear to my heart. Every entrepreneur has X amount of capital. It's a finite resource like the air we breathe. You need to get your project done with the amount of money you've got. And the best entrepreneurs get an amazing amount done with a relatively small amount of capital and constantly think about preserving capital and the investors who back them. And that is what they work for every day. To covet the engineering solution over the customer needs. So many of you in this audience are in the engineering school. This is not meant to be a derogatory comment, just an observation. There are great engineering and technological fixes to all kinds of problems. Those may or may not be the answer the customer really wants. And in many companies, big and small, you see again and again and again, the company comes up with a great engineering or technological fix to a problem, but the customer doesn't want it. And so this is the point, is to always understand the customer need. There's a simple principle called KISS, keep it simple, stupid. If you follow that one in general, you're usually going to take care of your customers pretty well. Don't make it too complicated. Seeking all possible funding sources. I heard today the university's energy group got a grant. There's all kinds of federal money running around out now. There's nonprofit organizations. There's venture capitalists. There's your friends and your neighbors and your family. Great entrepreneurs have ways to find capital, and they're tireless about finding funding sources. If they get somebody trapped in an elevator for 5 minutes, they make the pitch, and you never know what comes from that. So you need to really be ambitious in the way that you find money. And the last part is really true of great entrepreneurs. They're in it for the ride. Great entrepreneurs, and I know several who have made billions of dollars in their lives, and you might say after you made your first few billion, you take it easy. The true entrepreneurs, they're in it for the game. And they will get back up and try another company again because they just love the adventure of building a great company. And so it should be fun all along the way. In the early days of Genentech, there are legendary stories. People used to release pigs into our ho-ho parties. They would take somebody's favorite car, tow it away, crush it in the lot, put a crushed car back in the same spot for when the person came back as a practical joke. There's a lot of fun in really energetic high-tech companies, and it should be fun at all times, and that's part of exulting in the journey. Okay, so then I thought I'd tell you, entrepreneur, what's a great company? If some of you want to join a company instead of starting your own company, what are some of the characteristics of a great entrepreneurial company? They're often, at least in the technology world, founded on a fundamental breakthrough technology. Apple, I think you guys all know the story of Apple. A young guy named Steve Jobs was wandering around Stanford. There's a place called Xerox Park, which is a research place, and they had this device there that now you know of as the mouse that they didn't know what to do with, so he borrowed the mouse from Xerox Park. He got a little personal computer together and really single-handedly created the personal computer industry as you know it. Genentech was a company founded on the dream of recombinant DNA technology that was created kind of in the mid-70s by a couple of professors here in California, one at Stanford and one at Berkeley. And it was founded on the notion of recombinant DNA technology and everything you could do with that. I think you guys all know the Google story, a couple of bright young Stanford PhD students who had a better algorithm for internet search, and you know what happened from there. Intel was kind of a third generation, a team of people that had been at Fairchild Semiconductor, and before one company that, and found a better way to make semiconductor chips, and Intel, you know. Microsoft, a young, long-haired character who dropped out of Harvard, played a lot of poker, didn't make it through his freshman year, got together with a bunch of other young, kind of crazy guys, and started writing code, and Microsoft. So those are the technologies that the company started from. There are lots and lots of examples like that, but they start with some core fundamental technology that's usually a really great breakthrough and unclear what you're going to do with it. What's another characteristic of all these companies? Surprisingly, I was talking about this today. When we put a man on the moon, the average age of the engineer sitting in mission control in Houston was 28 years old. It is young people like yourselves who don't know what you can't do, who do the impossible in these kinds of companies. And all of them, including Google most recently today, have the ability to attract the most exceptional young people because, frankly, it is young people and your energy and enthusiasm that makes all these great companies go in the beginning. Genentech was the same. Now, my peer group at Genentech, I've been out of there a long time, are still relatively young people in their 40s and 50s now. They were in their 20s and early 30s when they got the great accomplishments done there. I talked about risk-taking and innovation, and you have to inculcate that as a culture. So all of these great companies somehow create a marvelous culture in the beginning that makes them sustainable and entrepreneurial over a long period of time. I think two parts of that culture are calculated risk-taking, the ability to really go out and do what can't be done and not be afraid to fail and to innovate, to just do the next thing. Again, it's another reason I think young people are so successful is you're not old enough to know what you can't do, so you just go ahead and do it. And it's that culture of risk-taking and innovation that's really, I think, a touchstone of great entrepreneurial companies. Target to create huge markets. I think that's obvious. All the companies in this example either created from scratch brand new whole markets, or they took the technology they had, in the case of Genentech, and went after ultimately the pharmaceutical industry. And typically in these companies, there is a truly dynamic, you might even say messianic leader who takes that company forward, a person who has all the characteristics of the Ten Commandments of the entrepreneur and probably more. I give you some examples here. Steve Jobs is Apple. Michael Dell is Dell Computers. Bob Swanson was the Genentech founder. Andy Grove at Intel and Bill Gates, I think some of you have heard of. truly inspired individuals who will do whatever it takes to succeed in an entrepreneurial environment. Typically, there's a leader like that in these companies. Okay, I'm going to just do three slides. I talked to you about the people and the companies. Intellectual property is what it's all about. So what do you own? What is it that makes you successful is intellectual property. These are some slides. You can read these. But in America, when you have a great technology company, you create intellectual property, the product of the human mind. That is what you own, and that's what gives value to the business. Without the underpinnings of the legal system that gave rise to intellectual property, you wouldn't have any of these technology companies because you wouldn't be able to own what you created. So these are the characteristics. There's four pieces of intellectual property. I'm going to talk about two of them, which are most relevant for technology companies. One is patents. It's actually in the United States Constitution. For any of those who happen to be constitutional scholars in the room, you'll find in Article 2, patents, the creation of patents actually was written by the Founding Fathers into the United States Constitution. Covers physical creations, so those things that you can touch and feel, although now they're actually business process patents. I'm not sure the founder said that in mind, but you can patent business processes as well. Three characteristics of a patent. It has to be novel. Nobody ever thought of it before. It has to have some fundamental utility. That is a practical and useful thing, and non-obvious, meaning that it wasn't just an apparent thing to think of. It's usually that aha moment of inspiration that gives rise to the greatest patents. U.S. patent law was changed in 1995. You now get 20 years of exclusivity from the date of filing. It is a constitutionally guaranteed monopoly. So in an old example of that, Polaroid instant cameras was a technology invented by a guy named Land. He had broad patents on the notion of Polaroid technology. The Kodak sued him. Judges said, you have an absolute monopoly. You have the right to practice monopoly under your technology, under a patent for the period of time. And the public policy notion behind that is once the patent expires, then everybody has the right to practice it. But for a period of time, you are rewarded by your inventive genius by an exclusive market monopoly guaranteed by the law, administered by the patent office. The other relevant piece of intellectual property for high technology companies is trade secrets and know-how. These are secrets. You don't tell anybody. They work by keeping them absolutely secret. The best example I've got up here is the formula for Coca-Cola. By legend, it's stored in a bank vault in Atlanta. Two living people at a time know what the formula is, and nobody else knows. And Coca-Cola has effectively protected the secret of Coca-Cola for almost a century now, and they've kept it that way as a trade secret. And so a lot of industrial espionage is all around hiring and trying to steal people's secrets, but this is the other way in the high-tech industry you protect your intellectual property. Okay, I'm going to switch gears to the middle part of the talk for you, the current startup environment. Everybody, those of you who read papers are certainly on the web and The Economist. It's a pretty ugly world out there right now. We'll get through this. What's going on in the financing world? Traditional funding sources, which is myself as a venture capitalist, have become more scarce. The good news is for entrepreneurs and for a lot of these young companies, the Obama administration has opened the spigot. The Energy Department is going to give away in the form of grants and loans over the next 18 months some $60 billion in funding targeted towards a variety of industries, particularly on clean energy technologies. Companies are cutting costs dramatically. There's layoffs going on. A real current focus on the bottom line of the business these days with a focus on being profitable companies and making positive contribution margins. I'm going to cover these areas later on, but there are a lot of opportunities in this. In fact, some of the greatest companies built were built in times of great crisis when there's intense focus on capital needs and creativity, and I'm going to go through these areas for you at the last part of the talk. And I think that there will be tremendous companies created right now in some of the kind of scariest times we're in. So I'm going to take you through now a bunch of data slides. These are pulled from VentureSource, which reports on funding issues for the venture capital industry. What you've got here is a chart. These are dollar flows by year into the venture capital industry in the United States. So for those of you who remember the tech bubble in 2000, take a look. People are rational economic maximizers. When the tech bubble was booming along, you had a record $84 billion in that year into venture capital, dwarfs all the rest of the years. 2001, the tech bubble blows up and the dollars fell off the face of the earth. We slowly started climbing back out of it, last year at $25 billion. This year in the first quarter, dollars flowing into venture capital firms was down more than 50% from last year, which you can see was already a relatively off year. So the funding sources, at least in the venture capital industry, have been significantly imperiled. So this is deal flow. This is categories of deals. So as you can see, information technology, which is the IT, by numbers of deals over the last In 9 years or so, has been pretty steady. About 50 to 60% of all deals that get financed are the information technology area. Healthcare has been pretty steady at the bottom, as you can see, around 25 to 30%. If we switch, now this is, these are dollars versus numbers of deals, and you take a look here, the category at the top in the pink or purple, energy and utilities, that's largely clean tech. And so what you can see as a category from 2001, where it's really not on the chart, until now 13% of all the dollars funded into venture-backed companies last year were into energy and utilities, but this is really clean technologies, and I'll cover some of that more. So a real trend of capital towards clean tech, this will continue. It'll be accelerated by the Obama administration's efforts. And as you can see, correspondingly, some of the other areas have dropped off. By round class, so in a venture-backed company, you have seed money, which is the very bottom small amount there, and then you have a first and second, third, subsequent financing rounds. So these are deal flows by the round class. More relevant is this following slide. This is really the dollars. So what you can see, which is probably not a surprise, your seed funding, which is your startup money, is the tiny little bar at the very bottom, 1% or less in all cases going back for the last 10 years, because those are small dollars. That's $100,000 or $500,000 to get your company started. By dollars, the later rounds, when the companies become more mature, is where the dollars really attracted the companies at that point, spending a lot more money, and that's where the largest part of the dollars go in. This is, by the way, all U.S.-based venture data. Geography. So the good news for those of you sitting in California, if you look at this chart, just under 50% of the dollars funded in the United States into venture capital go to California. As you can see, the Bay Area by far has the biggest share of that. That is a long-term trend that has continued over probably 20 years. A simple reason for that is the largest number of venture capitalists happen to also be in California. A lot of them don't like to fly and drive too far, so they just start companies in their own backyard. But the good news for you guys here is that California gets a huge disproportionate amount of venture capital. It's historically been a very innovative state. A massive amount of federal money is coming into the state of California. And so for innovative startup companies, you are already living in the right state. Okay, so how do you as an entrepreneur and we as venture capitalists make money? There's two ways. You take your company public on the stock market and you ultimately sell the stock to investors through the stock market, or you sell your company in what's called a merger and acquisition, M&A. This chart simply shows over the last decade the distribution of total exits between initial public offerings, that's the first time of selling your stock to the public, and M&A. And as you can see in the peak in the bubble, 99 and 2000, there was a lot of IPO, public stock activity that dropped off the face of the earth in 2001, 2002, and the bubble burst. It slowly climbed back, and in 2008, it was almost non-existent. 2009 will be worse. So that the only way that we investors and you entrepreneurs get paid back is the M&A exit. So let's see what that looks like. Well, unfortunately, that's also going down. M&A activity, merger and acquisition, dropped off dramatically last year. It's going to be worse in 2009. So this is a chart of the paid dollars paid. And what's important for, again, you as an entrepreneur and myself as an investor is the difference between the line graph in the blue and the bar graphs below. What you want to do is have what happened in 2000, which is the multiple between the dollar paid and the dollar invested is the highest. It was 10 to 1 there. 4 or 5 to 1 as recently as 2007, dropping back off. In the tough years for all of us, like 2002 and 2003, where you're lucky enough to sell your company, you're barely getting paid back more than the money put in. When that happens, I promise you the venture capitalists are first in line to cash the check, and you, the entrepreneur, actually get very little. The age of the companies is also, these are venture-backed companies, only in the United States, has gone up, as you can see. Historically, it's been kind of in the two, three, four-year range. It's crept up quite a bit. This is a time of the life of the company before it gets sold. The story is the same on the IPO front here. IPO activity, as I mentioned, has dropped off dramatically. These are venture-backed companies into IPOs. And the time to liquidity, which is the time from starting the company to having the initial public offering, as you can see again, has gone from kind of 3 years to 8 years. And so the companies are sticking around for a lot longer. They're taking more capital. The investors are not getting their money out, and therefore they're not cycling the money back into new companies. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears to the third part of the talk. There's lots of opportunity out there, all kinds of things that venture capitalists are interested in. I'm a life sciences investor, so I'm going to give you just a little bit of granular detail on life sciences. These are the macro things you are looking for as an entrepreneur. Remember I mentioned big markets. So here's some global population trends for you. You can see them. The world is getting older. You've got projections here between last year and 2025. In particular, the industrialized, wealthy northern hemisphere, the United States, Japan, and Europe, is getting much older. There will be a demand for all kinds of health care for people as we age, and it's an affluent society that will be able to afford it. In addition, in the United States in particular, the percent of our total gross domestic product that's going to healthcare has been on a steady linear climb. You can read the numbers for yourself. I will tell you the United States stands alone in this regard. Most, in fact, all of the other countries in the industrialized world spend about half as much of their gross domestic product on healthcare as the United States. But these are the numbers here, and as long as the United States keeps spending this kind of money, there will be opportunities. This is why in the Obama administration there's a huge push on reducing the cost of healthcare in this country, because this is a drag on all businesses. Good for investors, bad for the business in general. So what are we dealing with from a disease standpoint? On the left you have the leading causes of death in 2005 in the United States. I have a global number for you in 25 years out. It's basically the same problem. So we know the diseases that we face as life science investors. We know the challenges ahead of us. They aren't going to change, but they're still going to be there to be addressed, and we need to find solutions. So in the life sciences world, for those of you who might be interested in that, here are some fearless projections about what will be promising areas for the foreseeable future. The first, you've probably seen there's a big push in the Obama administration for electronic medical records. The system of tracking and storing your records as a patient is archaic. It's 19th century. You go into a doctor's office, they have all these crusty old paper files, and too many bad things happen to human beings in this country because we have a woeful system of keeping track of basic medical records. There's going to be a huge push in this administration to update this and go electronic, and that will give rise to many, many, many opportunities that cross over between the information technology side, the software and the hardware, and the algorithms, and the healthcare piece, which is the data records themselves. A lot of other things that are interesting. You've got a great nanotech center here at Santa Barbara. The advent of a lot of modern materials have given rise to amazing new medical devices, small, tiny devices. There's a camera now you can swallow. They'll take pictures of your intestines as it goes through your body. Advances in technology for implantable devices in the heart and tissues. Some really interesting things in the medical device arena, accelerated by material science and nanotechnology advances. Medical imaging, another really fascinating area where a lot of advances, again, going on here at your school, will let us be able to take a much better picture of you at the human level, at the tissue level, down to individual cells, what's going on and what's wrong with you. And then genetic testing, you've probably heard of 23andMe. The founder of that one happened to be married to one of the founders of Google. It's handy to have a good financial sponsor if you want to start a company. But 23andMe is all about kind of doing your own DNA testing and figuring out what diseases you're most likely to get. And there's a lot of this going on now. And what will happen beyond the basic work is you'll really know what to do with the genetic information besides just putting a nice pretty chart on your wall. My world, which is really the drug development world, the Human Genome Project in 2000, the Rose Garden, President Clinton introduced the two people in the race, Francis Collins at the NIH, and a guy named Craig Venter, who happened to have been my pharmacology professor in graduate school on the private side. The two of them raced, and we cloned the human genome. As a consequence of that now, we have access to all this genetic information that will be a great aid to the discovery of large molecules, pharmaceuticals in the future. And there are really two kinds of pharmaceuticals, the little pills that we've always taken most of our life, which are what are called small molecules, and then much more so now, natural biological molecules. Those are proteins and DNA from your body that are drugs in and of themselves, and there will be a lot of advances there. The U.S. Healthcare system, I think, is ripe for reform. Again, there's a huge political push for that. Anytime there's a seismic shift or a change in government policy, there's an opportunity for entrepreneurs, and so here, as we go through what will probably be real healthcare reform over the next few years, there'll be a lot of opportunities as the whole healthcare system is checked from top to bottom. Okay, switching gears now, the rest of this will be more technology-based. I think probably most of you know, cloud computing is the simple notion that You're not sitting on a computer in your home anymore, or your laptop. You are out on the web, in the cloud, as the picture goes. And the notion is that software and hardware are commodities now. The few dominant players, the opportunities for innovation in that are long since over. You can use the internet to access basically infinite storage and compute capacity for free, essentially, the cost of your bandwidth, your wireless access. And we're still continuing to generate just petabytes of information as we go along in this thing. Storage costs drop. And so there'll be a lot of new companies built around computing in the cloud, which is doing computational processes not on your local computer but out in the ether. And all kinds of companies are onto this whole new cloud computing notion. It's one of the hot buzzwords in the venture world. So the web. most of my life there was no web. The first generation of the web, which was kind of, you know, ended around 2000 when the bubble blew up, was a lot of companies that got you onto the web and a bunch of gee whiz things. It was all about traffic and metrics around usage. There were no good business models. And so when the tech bubble blew up, a whole lot of companies died or remade themselves. The version of the web we're in now, they just is called euphemistically Web 2.0, the second coming of the web. We now have ubiquitous broadband access, which is different from the first time, so you can get on fast and cheap. Traditional media is under siege. Television shows, newspapers, as you know, are dying off, and it's all because all the content is going to the web and more people simply digest everything from the web instead of traditional media sources. There are a lot of opportunities there for business. The current Web 2.0 business model is an advertising-driven model, so you attract people to your website for whatever it is they're doing, unless you happen to be selling pornography, which you can charge a lot of money. You have to get somebody else to pay for it because all of you in this room assume that the internet is free to you, even though it's not really true. And so the business model works as sponsors pay for the advertising, all the pop-ups and the spam you get, and that's the Web 2.0 model. The Web 3.0 model, which is still over the horizon, is one of mobile devices, which I'll touch on in a second, but the web will be pushed to you through your BlackBerry or your cell phone or your iPhone or whatever it is, and you will consume most of your web-based information on a small portable device. And there are a lot of applications going to make that work for you, from wireless and broadband access to Apple, and BlackBerry's just opened up their app shop to have applications for your mobile devices. And that sinks into mobile devices, which is a huge new area for investment and for companies. For about 20 years, the Wintel duopoly, which was Windows, Microsoft Windows, and Intel semiconductors, ruled the world. And it was kind of an ever-escalating nuclear arms race. They made a faster semiconductor chip that made your computer go faster, therefore you could load more software. Bill Gates sold you more software, it slowed your computer down, you needed a faster chip, and on it went. And those two companies made a lot of money for a long time in the Wintel duopoly. Now that's all a commodity. As I said, you can get compute power effectively for free. You can get it in the cloud through broadband access. So the day of the personal computer on your desk is largely over. Where the world is going is to small mobile devices. Everything is smaller and faster. And so you've got, again, the iPhone is just a brilliant device. I mean, that was really a quantum leap, I think, in a technology that made it really simple for the user to use it. You have now all kinds of companies springing up simply to do individual applications for the iPhone. Each one of those is a company. And I'm sure you guys have downloaded iPhone apps and used them for all kinds of things. Again, BlackBerry is trying to compete with them. We've looked at a very interesting company called Vigo, V-I-I-G-O, that's doing apps for the BlackBerry. And so there's lots and lots of these companies out there. And on the other side of this new duopoly, you have the mobile carriers and then the providers. Google and Yahoo are fighting, and Microsoft to own your portal to the web. And so that's where this world has gone. And this will be a new area for at least a decade or more of interesting companies and technologies. Clean tech. So let's spend a minute on this one. 5 years ago, nobody even talked about it. There was an environmental movement in the 70s. There's Earth Day. There's all that stuff. And then we've had these oil shocks. But we never as a country really got too serious about this until a guy who, as he likes to say, always was the next president of the United States. And, you know, he thought there were two outcomes. One was you win and one was you lose. And then there was that third version. That was Al Gore. So after he lost by a vote of 5-4 in the United States Supreme Court, he decided to go do something else with himself. He took his PowerPoint presentation. He ran around the world. And he did the show that's The Inconvenient Truth. And I think Al Gore gets a lot of credit for changing the perceptions of not just this country, but the world about climate change, global warming, carbon dioxide emissions. And so there's also been a political change. I think we all followed the last election. And there's the political will in this country, which did not exist in the prior administration, to really deal with carbon dioxide emissions. There is a big conference in Copenhagen in December where the world's going to get together, and I believe agree on a global strategy for combating global warming, particularly carbon dioxide emissions. The United States is likely to adopt, not this year, but next year, a cap-and-trade system, where if you're a large producer of carbon dioxide, you're going to have to pay for that. And there'll be a marketplace for carbon dioxide in which people who sequester carbon dioxide or find another way to take it out of the environment will get paid by the people who pollute. And all of this is a huge fundamental shift in the structure of the country and of business. And as an entrepreneur, you want to find these things and you want to ride the front end of those waves like you do out here on the beach. So long term, we're going to have issues about food use, energy use, water usage. But right now, it's all around clean technologies, ways to reduce the carbon footprint, the individual carbon footprint. As a side note, I think the real problem is the global population. Unless we can solve that and get the population of the planet down to a couple billion people, we're always going to be looking for the technological fix for the next problem. The good news is you guys will have jobs. The bad news is I don't think we're really addressing the fundamental cause of what we've got going on. Okay, so with the political commentary out of the way, where are there specific opportunities in clean technology? And you, again, are really privileged to have several centers here on the UC Santa Barbara campus dealing with energy and the environment, the Nanotech Center, and some of the best scientists in the world right here on campus doing things in this area. The energy sources are listed here. There are dozens and dozens of companies backed by venture capitalists today going after all of these, with the exception of nuclear, which is high capital cost, but the rest, solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, some fascinating stuff in the geothermal area of just drilling down a few thousand feet into the ground. You have a perpetual source of heat to make steam, but there are lots of different ideas, and all of these are around low-cost sources of non-fossil fuel energy. The electric grid in this country will be changed, so you take the power lines to the energy sources. That's an issue. And nuclear power is a huge debate. I think that nuclear power in this country will be a part of the solution, although probably not most of it. On the water side, huge issue. We all live in California and kind of watch the drought, third year of the drought. Water usage storage will be a continuing crisis as the population grows. We're not cutting our water usage so far, so we have to deal with sources of that, including desalination, which right now takes a tremendous amount of energy. And so there will be a lot of companies built around, again, usage purification of water. Building design is another really cool area. There's a guy in San Francisco, Bill McDonough, who's a cutting-edge green building guru, and they use all the modern tools and technologies and make buildings lower carbon footprint, lower energy usage, more light levels, better places for you to work instead of old artificially lit classrooms like this, places where they're enjoyable. A lot of very interesting things going in building materials and building design, building usage. And there's a lot of government incentives. I mentioned the stimulus bill was passed, it's $800 billion. I'm sure we're not done. The Department of Energy is taking the lead, but a lot of different parts of the federal government as well as state governments are putting a huge amount of money into grants and loans and outright gifts for people to start companies up. Okay, so I'm going to finish with the best idea you ever heard. This is the hairy future. If you want to combine everything you know into making yourselves true gazillionaires, you can take material science, biology, technology applications, everything that you know, and put them together. And if you can solve this problem, you will ultimately succeed in life. And I guarantee you a lot of money out of this one. With that, I'll close and take questions.
So I have a class with Robin Campbell from Aventis. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but life sciences course. And basically one of the recurring themes is the myriad reasons why biotech is unprofitable. And so, but do you think like with the influx of federal money and kind of a move for basically first world healthcare models to preventative medicine and uninvasive means of treatment and diagnosis, do you think they can actually see some profitability in the near future?
Okay, so the question is, the current model of life sciences biotech is broken. I agree with that, by the way. And then are there new advances that will change that model? Yes and no. A lot of the diagnostics things that I mentioned will be really game-changing for people to figure out when diseases are coming so you can treat them in advance, lifestyle alterations. A lot of the genetic testing, that information will be useful. I talked about medical devices where I think there'll be a lot of breakthroughs. The problem on the drug side, for which there is not currently a solution, is the Food and Drug Administration. It's a regulated industry. The government has made it harder and harder and harder to get a new drug approved. The costs, you pick a number, it's about $1 billion when you include failures to get a new drug approved. And unless until we change the dynamic by which the government regulates and approves new drugs, which we have not addressed, that part of the equation is not yet solved.
I'm probably the youngest person in here who doesn't know the answer to this, but would you describe a little bit how the venture capital industry operates in a practical sense?
Absolutely. And I was counseled in advance that you guys all knew Venture 101, so I avoided that, but thanks for asking because I wasn't so sure. So it's the venture capital industry. We are a middleman, as it were. We get our money from lots of sources. They're large buckets, but pension funds like the California CalPERS, California Public Employee Retirement System, so big pension plans, university endowments, private foundations. In some exceptions, very high net worth individuals, usually from organizations that pool retirement funds. So they will allocate their funds the way you would allocate your personal finances, and they will allocate typically 2 to 5% of their total money towards what's called private equity, which is venture capitalists and the buyout guys who are now out of favor. And so, but that's a huge pie, trillions and trillions of dollars, for which we get a couple of percent. And so we take our money from those pension funds, who in turn get their money from you in the audience. We then screen the entrepreneurs and pick individual entrepreneurs and back them with investments and sit on the boards of directors and hopefully help those companies to be successful, build themselves up, and either go public or get sold successfully. And then we recycle that money back to those limited partners, hopefully making returns back for them, for the pension plans, back circles back around. And that's how we work. And you typically raise a fund that lasts for about 3 or 4 years, so enough money to invest for a period of 3 or 4 years, with capital to follow on and protect that company over a period of time. I showed you the kind of 6 to 8 year life cycle. So you raise the funds and invest it usually in 3 or 4 years. The funds typically have a 10-year life cycle. It's usually extended by a year or two, and that's to take care of the kind of 8 to 10 year life cycle of the companies you invest in. A typical venture investment, it varies by category. A typical information technology company might take $30 to $40 million of capital total from 4 to 5 venture firms, so $6 to $8 million per firm. They tend to do these in groups together. The biotech life sciences companies, because we can easily spend $300 or $400 million in a company trying to develop a drug, will raise $100 or $200 million of private capital. The clean tech models, so far as early days, they're raising massive amounts of capital to go into building big pilot plants and ventures like the corn ethanol system. Software companies have historically been low capital usage, so it depends a little bit by sector how much money you put into these companies. Is that quick?
The typical returns for the VC.
Historically, the returns for venture capital is it's called an internal rate of return, an IRR. For those of you who aren't finance folks, that's kind of like an interest rate. Historically, until the last trough, venture firms returned 20 to 30% annual returns. So we were considered high-risk, high-return capital. Again, if you're a big pension fund, you'd put some money in bonds, some money in stocks. We were considered the most risky, but also the highest-returning part of the portfolio. So historically, venture firms returned 20-30% a year on the investment in exchange for the risk that they took. That has not worked in the last 10 years. In fact, the venture industry is under siege largely because we've gone now through two troughs where I showed you the numbers. We have not made that much money, and so the venture capital industry as a whole is under some stress right now because we have not as an industry returned the kind of returns historically that we've returned in exchange for the risk that we take. So let's see. I will tell you that my group has continued to return nicely for our investors, but it's been a hard game. Bill, I think you got one right in front of you there.
Hi. I'm curious to know about what you think about the current trend of venture philanthropy and investments in social enterprises, both internationally and in the U.S., if this is just sort of a trend, if this is something that's going to be continuing, just some thoughts on that.
So venture philanthropy, I guess I wouldn't call it a trend. There are two groups that I know of that are very active in this area. Google, about 2 or 3 years ago, created the separate Google nonprofit with a lot of money to give to good causes. And it's early days, and they've got some very bright people running it. And let's see, everything Google's done so far has been right. There's a small Bay Area group, a friend of mine actually helps run it, that invests on behalf of individuals into venture firms like my own, but all of the gains go to nonprofits. So that's a different model, and that's worked for a long time, very successfully. They have access to really good venture capital firms, and they take the gains and they plow it back in. In general, though, there is not much venture philanthropy. Rather, it works as follows. Bill Gates is probably the poster child. An individual like Bill Gates or Michael Dell or Warren Buffett make a lot of money as an entrepreneur, and at some point in their life they decide that they're going to give it back to the world. And they then set up a personal foundation, which is what Bill Gates did with his dad, and that foundation gives to charity personal wealth. That's much more the model than really venture philanthropy is not something that I think really exists in this country today, nor may it ever, but let's see.
You mentioned that there was the new duopoly of low-cost internet wireless or internet access and low-cost wireless providers like cell phones such as the iPhone or whatever. How long do you think it will take for the applications to be reaching a point of like saturation where there's too many, not profitable?
That's a very good. So the question was, for all the mobile devices out there, how long will it take to saturate the applications that people use? In one sense, there's always the next killer app, is what the tech guys say. So maybe think about Google as an analogy, right? There was search, there was Ask Jeeves, there was a ton of search. Google showed up kind of late in the game. They obviously did search way better than the first guy, so they now basically own search. I think the analogy is reasonable in that there's always some next great application for your device that you can come up with. But I think, the golden days are going to be over the next 5 or 10 years, probably the next 5 years, where there are going to just be a flood of applications to turn your little handheld device, instead of just the things it does, and the iPhone is brilliant, what it can already do, into really a completely, fully functional device for anything you can possibly imagine. So I think most of those apps are going to be developed in the next 5 years or so, but I think there will always be some great killer app beyond that that somebody will think of. You're only limited by your imagination.
Hi. In your opinion, which clean energy source will probably be the most profitable for venture firms?
So the question is clean energy source. So far, the data are actually compelling. Wind power is the only currently profitable alternate energy source without government subsidies. And it's fairly profitable so that you can put up a wind plant and finance with traditional project financing and make a return on that. No other alternate energy source today is profitable without subsidies, including solar. In fact, Germany is the huge solar kind of innovative marketplace because the German government has mandated solar and has incented it through all kinds of rebates. Over time, as these industries build up and more consumers switch over to the alternate energy sources, I think several of them will become profitable, and that's the venture capitalist's risk, right, is to back some business that isn't profitable today that you sure hope is going to be profitable in the future. I think that some of the geothermal plays are really fascinating because they are kind of, it's a single, you can use old-fashioned oil drilling technology, you drill a hole in the ground, at a certain level below the surface, it's always hot all the time, you pump water down there and cycle. There's a lot of interesting innovations there, and the beauty of that is that you can put the power source where you need it. So instead of running, the problem with most of the rest of these, the problem with the wind farms, they're West Texas, the wind blows all the time apparently, I don't know if it's the politicians or the air. But the wind blows all the time. The problem is the power lines don't run to West Texas. And so for a lot of these energy sources, if you have to reroute the entire electrical grid of the United States, that's a huge capital cost. In the geothermal, if you want to have a power plant in some remote mine, you just drill down a certain depth, and there's your power plant locally on site. So I think it's going to vary. I think on some of the biofuels, I think bioethanol is never going to work in this country as a profitable business. It's already been shown. It just costs too much to grow the crops you need to use it. So I think there are already some clear losers in this game. Most of it, the jury is out. Nuclear if you took away the public stigma and the kind of regulatory hurdles, nuclear is profitable from time zero for a project finance basis, but you've got the other issues that go along with it. So wind today is the only one, with the exception of nuclear, which there's been no new nuclear plant permit in the United States in 25 years. Geothermal, I think, will come, and some of the other ones may never get there. You got to wait for the mic, Tom.
Thank you. With regard to the solar, do you have sort of a VC magic number as to what efficiency needs to be realized by solar panels before they would be profitable? And secondly, it would seem that the VCs would shy away from the solar technologies today. I noticed that there's already been layoffs by many of the companies around the world, and yet there's new solar energy equipment, panel makers and equipment makers going on in Vietnam and in Japan, China, and Korea. So all of these things seem to be growing on the one hand, but yet the margins aren't there, as you said.
Yep. So the question's kind of broadly about solar power and what are the dynamics, if they exist, to make solar power profitable. There's two parts. As I understand this, there is some asymptotic efficiency of solar panels that we're actually getting relatively close to. It's somewhere around 30 or 35% efficiency for current technologies, rooftop panels. And we're at the really most efficient panels, which are high-use industrial. We're maybe at 26, 28%. So we're approaching some efficiency curve. But that's on existing technologies, by the way. So I think somebody will come up with a better technology that'll solve that problem. So we can go further up the efficiency curve for sure. That's a part of it. The other part is just pure supply and demand, mass volume, right? SunPower was the big Bay Area high flyer early, went public, made a fortune for people, and it's come back off. I think when you get much more broad-based usage, so that solar panels are put on every house or most houses, and every big industrial business like Walmart puts solar on the roof, so that you have huge demand for the panels, what you're going to do is drive down dramatically the cost. Just like look at television sets, right? I mean, 10 years ago, a flat panel TV that was kind of 30 inches was a $4,000 TV, and now you can get a 80-inch flat panel TV for the same $4,000. And what happened there is they built these massive fab plants at billions of dollars a piece. They've got a production volume and scale, and they can just make bigger devices. The same thing is going to happen with solar. And so as demand increases and there's much broader use, you'll reduce the cost of installing it. And so for the consumer, what you care about is the break-even point for you to pay to put it on your roof. And I think those two parts of the equation solve it: greater efficiency and just lower cost of the panels. And we will absolutely make progress in both of those, and I think that's why venture folks continue to invest in these companies.
When you use solar fumes, there's a lifetime, and then does anybody think about when they are out of their life, what's the effect to the environment to dispose those solar fumes?
Like the solar cells?
Yeah.
So that's a good question. Everything has to be recycled. I don't know that there is necessarily yet an existing good technology for recycling the solar panels. Most of them are only, 5 years or less old. They'll probably have to solve that, as all the rest of these things. With every breakthrough, then there's another problem and another solution, which is what makes technology fun. There's always another problem to solve. I don't know that I have the answer, or the answer is known today, for the ability to recycle the solar panels or what they'll do. I'm sure they can recycle some of the component parts. A piece of it is that the chemistry, which is these are silicon-based technologies largely that are in the solar panels, just a thin film of silicon that really is doing the magic. That there'll be innovations in the chemistry and new chemical materials, and so it may not make sense to recycle the old panels. And the glass is potentially recyclable in the other materials. And I'm sure people will come up with that. As we get more solar panels, there'll be a business for recycling. But today, I don't think there is an answer of efficient recycling of the solar panels.
Rod Ferguson, thank you for joining us today in Santa Barbara.
Thank you, folks.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.